Thursday, January 25th, the city was in a state of tension that had been mounting ever since Monday when North Korea had seized our ship, the Pueblo. Nevertheless, my first appointment of the day was a happy one. I called the best porter, Permana, whom I'd run into the day before at the opening of the Woman's National Democratic Club, and asked her and her husband to come by and have coffee with me. We met in the West Hall at 10:30, and it was just as though we had said goodbye the day before. We hadn't even come to a period, just a comma, because we were both full of questions about each other's children and friends. Linda had stayed with her in Jacksonville when she was courting Bernie. She looks prettier and happier than she did 10 years ago, and it's such a pleasure to be able to say that. We chattered nearly an hour, and then I worked with Ashton and Marilyn. Bess came over, and we worked on guest lists, having lunch on trays. Somewhere in the morning, the news came to me that Lyndon had called up the reservists, Air Force and Navy, about 14,000 of them, for active duty. An answer, partial, to the North Koreans seizing our ship. Linda breezed through the room, saying, "Well, I just asked Chuck if you want me to pack warm clothes for Vietnam or cold clothes for Korea." She could just maintain that brave front with a touch of humor for a year, I'd be as relieved as every mother of a serviceman. At one, I went over to the swearing-in in the cabinet room of Jerry Williams as chairman of the administrative conference. Fair Pearl is prettier than ever, very blonde now. I welcomed them aboard, and what a day to be joining the government. Told them someone had dropped out because of illness from the dinner for tonight, and would they like to come? They would. Back on the second floor, I talked with Linda about the repairs we are doing to the children's bath at the ranch. How my heart does turn there. And then I worked with Ashton, and Liz came over looking like the sky had fallen.
Gardner.
Secretary Gardner's resignation had been announced, and the Viet Cong were attacking at Khe Sanh in what looked like it might be a major offensive. We were badly outnumbered there. What a day. Of course, I had had 5 days to absorb the shock and pain of Gardner's resignation. When we finished with letters and invitations, answers to little pieces of paper, I shoved back from my desk and went over to the EOB for 2 fast, hard games of bowling. They do help. And back upstairs, Jean-Louis gave me a very fancy up hairdo, and I put on a gold lamé dress brought to me by Chief of State and made up by Dell Simpson, and fared forth to the first big dinner of 1968. With, I hope, a brave front, if a sinking heart, on an inauspicious an evening as could be. First, I did a few pictures. I shall do this before each major dinner, so that just by chance I should get 1 or 2 good evening dress pictures with which to answer requests, rather than sending out such old ones. And then into the yellow room to greet the honor guests of the evening, Hubert and Muriel, the Speaker and Miss Harriet, and the Chief Justice and Mrs. Warren. I always think of this as a sort of family party, and how easy it is to forget that the Chief Justice is a member of the other political party. This dinner has a very different feel from one honoring a Chief of State. The honor guests upstairs were members of their family, Hubert and Muriel's 4 children, and their spouses, Skip and Nancy Lee, Bob and Donna, Nancy and Bruce. Bruce has lost some great amount since our visit out there in September and looks just great. And cute little Doug Humphrey with his date, Jan Thompson, whose black eyes were dancing the whole evening. For the Speaker and Mrs. McCormick, there was his handsome nephew, Ed McCormick Jr., and his pretty wife. Miss Harriet is so much more feeble than I've ever noticed her before. The Chief Justice and Mrs. Warren had their children, Dorothy and Mr. and Mrs. Daly. I found myself talking too fast and too much, a sort of attempt to combat the gloom that the troubles of the day brought down. When the honor guard came in, and this is the first time that I remember when it has not been led by Chuck, I missed him, moved less skillfully, with something less of that ballet precision. We followed them downstairs, I going with my husband this time, and the Speaker and Miss Harriet using the elevator but joining us at the foot of the step for pictures. And then we marched on in, and just as we reached the door, an unprecedented thing happened. The room burst into spontaneous applause. Never before has it happened that I remember, either to us or to any other president, within my knowledge. We stood in line, this time in the middle of the room, in front of the stage, and the guests, nearly 190, filed by, all chosen to do honor to our 3 honorees. The whole court, and retired justices Reed and Clark, were invited because this is a special night for their chief. And for the vice president, the whole cabinet was invited. The Gardners had regretted early, even before he had talked to Lyndon. And the Udalls regretted. I wondered if it was significant. Someone told me he was doing a tape for a Johnny Carson show. And Linda said he was on the program to pass out the awards at a YMCA dinner she was attending. And Nancy Trowbridge had called late in the day to regret for both of them. He had been hospitalized with chest pains. Your mind leaps to heart attack, and you do not know how serious. And that is another black note of this black day. From the Senate, there was Melton Young and Margaret Chase Smith, looking composed and serene as always, and the Phil Harts of Michigan. But there were a lot of regrets from the Senate. There were two governors, the Hughes of New Jersey, they were our house guests, and the Kings of New Hampshire. She never loses an opportunity to say something nice to me about how much her husband thinks of my husband. Here also, among the governors, there had been several regrets. As the guests went down the line, I sensed something of what I suppose is the feeling in the country. One pressed my hand, another murmured, "We're praying for you." Another, I think, tried to convey sympathy and understanding with a look. I do not think it had any particular reference to Lyndon and Lady Bird Johnson. I think it simply meant, "You're the president, and we know it's tough, and we're in it with you." The House of Representatives was here in some force. The speaker's leaders, Carl Albert and Hale Boggs, and the opposition leader, Jerry Ford, Betty looking very pretty, the heads of committees like George Mahon and Mendel Rivers, Wilbur Mills had regretted, a sizable contingent of those with seniority, such as Wright Patman. I had invited his sister to come with him, and she and Wright were, I think, the two happiest people in the room, which pleased me very much to make possible. From government, there were the Lawson Knotts and Arthur Oakens, he's to be the new head of the Council of Economic Advisors. And from labor, I.W. Abel of the Steelworkers, and Joseph Keenan, and the ubiquitous George Meany, and the James Suffrages. The most regal light of the entertainment world, Helen Hayes, was there. I'd put her at my table. And David Merrick and Alexander Schneider, the concert violinist. Two of the most attractive men were Edwin Etherington, the president of Wesleyan University, and Edward Bennett Williams. It was quite a press contingent. The William Randolph Hearst, our old friends, the Marshall McNeils, our old friend and oft-times critic, Drew Pearson and Louvy, Victor Rissell in his dark glasses leaning on his wife's arm, the Walter Trohans, and I got to tell his wife face to face what he'd said about being married 40 years. That was at the press dinner in Williamsburg, and an accolade for any woman. The Bill Whites were there, our old friends, the Hunter McLeans from Texas, and several, both from high position and staff, that we'd ask at the last minute when people had dropped out because of illness. The Clark Cliffords, the Ernie Goldsteins, the John Crookers, the Jim Rose. I think Betty Beale's estimate was fair. The mood was warm and friendly, but not gay. I found myself pushing against the wall of gloom, hoping that I could reassure, help make it a good evening. Of course, I was lucky at my table. The vice president always sits at my right there, and he has that golden gift of happiness and making those around him happy. Mr. King, the wife of the governor, was next, and then the chief justice, and Helen Hayes, and Mr. Schneider, and then Mrs. Hearst, very slim and very elegantly dressed, and Jim Rowe, and then Mrs. McCormick and the speaker. It was a good table for talk, and stars though they were, Helen Hayes and Mr. Schneider really had to bow to Hubert this evening, I think. He was telling, apropos of tales of the stage that had been begun on their side of the table, about his father in the little town of Huron, South Dakota, I believe it is, where he was born and raised. He used to buy time on the radio to read poetry. His wife would fuss at him for wasting the family's money, which wasn't plentiful, and he'd say, "But they need it." Tales of how he would go once a year to Chicago or New York to hear grand opera or concerts, of how the whole family would be called on to give their opinions on some public issue. We all mourn the passing of real conversation. And was it TV that killed it, or what happened to family life? It was a lively, fun evening. Lyndon made the first toast, paying tribute to the American system of checks and balances. He said, "There have been times in our history when check and balance really meant stop and freeze," and then went on to say, "But after the strong opinions have been aired, the people want progress. They want checks and balances, and then they want forward movement. Hubert's toast, it seemed to me, and I was right by him, was completely without notes, the warmest, most personal one, ending with asking us to raise our glasses in tribute to a man who is firm and resolute, strong and kind, and governs with compassion. As always, when the speaker rose, I was surprised. From that frail and aging body, that hollow-eyed, gray-thatched head, there emerged this strong, powerful, sure voice. He is truly a professional. And he generously included all of Lyndon's family in his toast. The Chief Justice's theme was unity in perilous times. And then we were off to the red room or the hall or the green room for coffee and liqueurs, and very shortly into the east room. I'd already gotten two looks from Lyndon that said hurry. I introduced the entertainment for the evening rather lamely, and we launched into about 30 minutes of I Do, Gordon McRae and Carol Lawrence. That ranks among the best entertainments we've had in the White House. Although, regrettably, however, we cannot excerpt 30 minutes from this play that lasts well over 2 hours and retain the full exquisite balance of happiness and fussing. Tonight was a trifle heavy on the fussing side. Even so, it was a good antidote for the day, a far cry from all the worries that these men had brought into that room. The speaker and Miss Harriet began the exodus as soon as the entertainment was over, and Lyndon went upstairs a little before 12. Nice. I think everybody could understand, because he did look gray and weary. He'd had hardly any sleep the 2 nights before. There was one light touch to the evening, though. Abe and Alexander Snyder took 2 violins from the Marine Orchestra and began to play a bit of Mozart. Lyndon, about to depart, leaned over to George Meany and said, "Do you reckon Abe has a union card?" Linda and Chuck came from the YMCA dinner, but it had turned out that Chuck had to present the award. Others expected to, didn't show. I, too, left a little past 12 and found Lyndon and the Hughes having a nightcap in the West Hall. I sat down with them. Lyndon disappeared soon, but I stayed, and we talked until nearly 1. I'm so glad to have people of their caliber and skill in the political field. And humor and good common sense are high on the list of their characteristics, to my thinking. They seemed really pleased to be in the Queen's room. I suggested that the governor might slip across the hall into the Lincoln room if he wished. Mm-hmm. And then I bid them good night and called it an end to this tough day.